We begin this week with new efforts underway to take all the data that's swirling around in medical labs and hospital record rooms and making sense of it in a way that actually helps move medicine forward. President Obama proposed a big boost in research into what's now called precision medicine during his State of the Union address. It's been a recurring theme in medicine over the past decade that finally, with better understanding of the human genome coupled with massive amounts of data, we're going to be able to craft treatments that move beyond one size fits all into something that is personally tailored to you. I asked Sound Medicine's ethics expert, Dr. Eric Meslin, who has done a lot of work in this field, to walk us through some of the challenges, starting with what we call it.
We've been trying for years to come up with a good term that captures all the accuracy of science and what we can do with genetics, and remembering that we're trying to apply it to the care of patients. So whether it's precision or personalized or targeted, we're really talking generally about the same thing. And I guess some of it's branding, but to be perfectly honest, it may be the best term we've come up with, mostly because the word personalized, as in personalized medicine, is pretty old. Doctors have always thought that the care they have provided was personalized. So this is a bit of a technical spin on an old topic.
Okay. Well, this effort is partly due to the intersection of lower costs for genetic sequencing and really the power of big data. Is that correct?
Yeah, it really is. And adding to that big data story are really two streams that are now crossing very nicely. One is, as you say rightly, the ability to look deeper and deeper into the human genome and find more and more interesting things at lower cost. What a great opportunity. Plus, the longstanding interest that we've had in electronic health records and the ability to gather health information more generally. So when you've got genetic information from that little drop of blood that you might give or a tumor sample or something else, and then you match it against a family history and health records, you've got a really powerful tool for diagnosing and treating disease.
So President Obama made the analogy that this is like matching blood donors, you know, and I'm thinking, okay, there's A, B, and O. You know, it seems like this is just a little bit more complex than that, but what is it a good analogy?
Well, you know, in this case, I think the idea is as much about finding the right information that will help the right patient get the right drug and the right treatment at the right time. You use that word right a lot, and it sounds very powerful. We've had this ability for at least 10 years or so, looking at genes and trying to figure out whether misspellings in the genome make someone more likely to respond to a drug or not. So that the technology is not brand spanking new, but I think the more interesting part of the announcement by the president is that we're probably going to enter the world that many other countries, including the United Kingdom, have entered, and that's involving more and more people in what is essentially a large database, a large biobank, where people can sign up and agree to participate in a pretty big study.
Mm-hmm. Well, and more than half the budget is going towards recruiting 1 million volunteers. I mean, what will they be asked to do, and what really will we get from that?
Well, this sort of reminds me of that game that people played in the parks when they were young, and you'd decide who was going to go up to bat first, and someone would put their hand on the bat, and someone would put their hand higher up the bat. So you've had large studies going on for many years, the Framingham study, the nurses study. There are many longitudinal studies where we've tracked people and their health. And what this is doing is it's adding a genetic component to many of those existing studies and then creating another one on top of it. So, for example, the United Kingdom has this large and very active project called the UK Biobank, where 500,000 Britons agreed to roll up their sleeve and give a blood sample or a cheek swab, and that would be deposited into a large repository that scientists with ethics permission and science approval could go in and start learning things. So not to be outdone, the UK had 500,000, so we're going to have 1 million. The important thing is not like it's some space race, whoever has the most people wins. On the other hand, whoever has the most people in their banks can actually learn more specific information, learning more, as they say, about the misspellings of someone's genome, so that we find a patient who has a particular kind of cancer might be more responsive to a drug than someone else. You can only learn that with more and more and more and more data. And the fun part about the U.S. is we've also got, in addition to great scientists, we've got some of the the wicked fastest computers in the world to do all these calculations.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the ethics, though, and the kind of the privacy aspect of it, because, you know, in the UK, you have government medical care, and it really doesn't matter if you have some problems because the insurance company isn't going to deny you care. Here, it's different.
Although in the UK, they're finding the same issues. I don't think this is a uniquely American problem. Anytime you create large repositories of personal health information, you raise the specter of not just privacy and confidentiality, who will learn secrets of my genome that I'd rather they not know, but I might also learn things about myself or my family or those close to me that I wasn't prepared for. In addition to the privacy concerns, which I personally think can be handled with some good governance and some good regulation and good guidelines. There are also issues around commercialization, who is going to be using this information for what purpose. Again, I have no problem with good collaborations between industry and universities, but we've got to have proper rules in place and we have to make sure that everybody knows who's doing what.
No, we hear more about targeted therapy when it comes to cancer treatment, so is that the area where we might see the first breakthroughs, or are there other areas of science and medicine that we might?
That's the main announcement that the president made, and there has since been some very important further announcements by the NIH and others, by Dr. Collins, the director of the NIH, describing cancer as one of the most important areas for a couple of reasons. One is, first of all, cancer doesn't discriminate. Lots of people get cancer, and there are lots of different types of cancer. But there are also a number of cancers that are, relatively speaking, rare. Not many people have them. And there is this fear, or there has been this fear, that since there really isn't a market for drugs to treat people with a pretty rare cancer, there's not going to be much development. We've seen that in some areas already. Well, using these high technology ideas and actions by scientists, we're probably able to do more for more cancers now than ever before. Maybe, possibly, fingers crossed, living up to Richard Nixon's almost infamous statement from 40 years ago that we're declaring a war on cancer. Much as I don't like the military metaphor, I think we're a lot closer to conquering some of those diseases than we were before.
All right, Eric, it's always good to have you here. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Dr. Eric Meslin directs the IU Center for Bioethics. Another scientist who will be watching how this marriage of genomics and big data moves forward is Dr. Andrew Hsu of the Scripps Research Institute in California. And recently he explained that when you're talking about big data, you're dealing with three Vs: volume, variety, and velocity. And each poses its own challenge.
Organizing big data is a huge challenge, right? If we talked about the 10 zettabytes of data that exist in the world, probably a very small proportion of that is in a format that can be easily integrated and mined.
Yeah, so what are some of the more likely ways that experts might use the power of big data to improve our health, maybe in the near future, an example?
So, I think there are definitely potential advantages in sort of the efficiency of healthcare. As we're able to integrate more and more across our medical records, I think that will be just an improvement in the efficiency of how healthcare is delivered. You also have, especially through the sensors, you have potential for patients to be more engaged in their own healthcare. So if I have continuous readings on my activity levels and my, cholesterol levels, it may encourage me to be more attentive to my own personal health care. And then from my personal point of view, my research program really focuses back on better understandings of the mechanisms of health and disease, so sort of the basic genomics research. And there, if you, for example, take cancer as an example, traditionally, right, cancer is mostly treated based off of the tissue of origin, right? Do you have kidney cancer versus lung cancer versus breast cancer and so forth? But what we're increasingly finding as we have new technologies to interrogate these tumors is that oftentimes the molecular basis of these different tumors in different sites often share more in common with each other than initially appreciated. So, for example, there is a particular mutation that is often found in skin cancer, And now we are observing it also in colon cancers and ovarian cancers. So it suggests that those cancers, regardless of where they originated, the cancers that share a common mechanism should be treated more similarly than other subtypes of these cancers.
Now, your research group recently received a grant from the NIH. What aspect of big data will your project be looking at?
Right. So this grant is part of an NIH initiative on big data and transforming that to knowledge. The particular themes of our center, there's one piece about building infrastructure for big data analysis, so community infrastructure that many people can use. The theme there is often bringing the analysis routines to the data warehouses themselves. So data analysts aren't, you know, downloading terabytes and terabytes of data. Let's actually bring the analysis routines to where the data live. A second theme that we have is on cardiovascular health. We have researchers in our consortium who have a heavy interest in how we organize molecular data around cardiovascular disease. And a third theme, I would say, and this is the particular emphasis of my lab, is how we think about crowdsourcing and citizen science in the context of big data. Can we build platforms that allow the entire community to collectively and collaboratively work together on some of these big challenges?
And as we get better at using batches of information at this level, will it become easier to translate raw data into this practical information that we can use for our health?
And this is the million-dollar question, right? And I think it highly depends on having some well-trained individuals. And this, again, is one of the main emphases of the NIH's Big Data Initiative, is making sure we have a workforce that understands the power of big data, but also has the practical skill sets to answer some of these questions.
Okay, well, first stop, we'll all take statistics, all right? So the kids out there has to take basic statistics and start from there.
No doubt.
All right. Well, Andrew Hsu, thank you so much for joining me, and thank you for your wonderful examples of what big data is. I think I understand it a lot better now, thanks to you.
Great. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Dr. Hsu is an associate professor of molecular and experimental medicine at the Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla, California.
Big data, bigger brother. Don't bother running, they're right behind you. They got your picture, they stole your number. Well, click, click there, right behind.